Do you know what his last words were?
Arianna shook her head.
He said, At least I had a good breakfast. Then he died.
Why didst thou bring him here, since thou didst know he was already dead?
Arianna asked him gently. The lean, bitter-faced serf shrugged.
I did not want to leave him just lying in a muddy ditch like a dead dog, he replied. In his whole life, nobody ever treated him as if he mattered at all. He was my friend, and I did not want to leave him there like a pile of garbage.
He laughed a short, bitter laugh.
I don't suppose that it matters very much to him, but at least there's a little bit of dignity here.
He awkwardly patted the dead man's shoulder.
Oh, sorry, Detton. But I guess I'd better go back to the fighting.
What is thy name, friend?
I'm called Lemer, my lady.
Is the need urgent for thee in the battle?
I doubt it, my lady. I have been shooting arrows at the Malorians. I'm not very good at it, but it is what I am supposed to do.
My need for thee is greater, then. I have many wounded here, and few hands to help with their care. Despite thy surly exterior, I sense a great compassion in thee. Wilt thou help me?
He regarded her for a moment.
What do you want me to do?
Taiba is boiling cloth for bandages over that fire there. See to the fire first, and then thou wilt find a cart just outside with blankets in it. Bring in the blankets, Gulema. After that I will have other tasks for thee.
All right,
Lemer replied laconically, moving toward the fire.
What can we do for her?
The Princess Tenedra demanded of the misshapen Belden. The princess was staring intently into Polgara's pale, unconscious face as the sorceress lay exhausted in the arms of Durnik the smith.
Let her sleep, Belden grunted. She'll be all right in a day or so.
What's the matter with her?
Durnik asked in a worried voice.
She's exhausted, Belden snapped. Isn't that obvious?
Just from raising a breeze? I've seen her do things like that,
and more that looked harder. You don't have the faintest idea of what you're talking about, blacksmith,
Belden growled at him. The hunchbacked sorcerer was himself pale and shaking.
When you start tampering with the weather, you're putting your hands on the most powerful forces in the world. I'd rather try to stop a tide or uproot a mountain than stir up a breeze in dead air.
The Grolems brought in that storm, Durnik said.
The air was already moving. Dead calm air is altogether different. Do you have the remotest idea of how much air you've got to move to stir even the faintest breath of air? Do you know what kind of pressures are involved, how much all that air weighs?
Air doesn't weigh anything,
Tenedra protested.
Really? Belden replied with heavy sarcasm. I'm so glad you told me. Would the two of you shut up and let me get my breath?
But how is it that she collapsed and you did not?
Tenedra protested.
I'm stronger than she is, and more vicious. Paul throws her whole heart into things when she gets excited. She always did. She pushed beyond her strength. It exhausted her.
The twisted little man straightened, shook himself like a dog coming out of the water, and looked around, his face bleak.
I've got work to do. I think we've pretty much worn out the Malorian Grolems. But I'd better keep an eye on them, just to be safe. You two stay here with Paul, and keep an eye on that child.
He pointed at Erend, who stood on the sandy beach with his small face very serious. Then Belden crouched, shimmering already into the form of a hawk, and launched himself into the air almost before his feathers were fully formed. Tenedra stared after him as he spiraled upward over the battlefield, and then turned her attention back to the unconscious Polgara. The charge of Corradulan's membrane knights came at the last possible moment. Like two great scythes, the armored men on their massive chargers sliced in at a thundering gallop from the flanks with their lances leveled and cut through the horde of Murgos rushing toward the waiting pikemen and legionnaires. The results were devastating. The air was filled with screams and the sounds of steel striking steel with stunning impact. In the wake of the charge lay a path of slaughtered Murgos, a trail of human wreckage 100 yards wide. King Khohag, sitting on his horse on a hilltop some distance to the west, nodded his approval as he watched the carnage.
"He's good," he said finally.
He looked around at the eager faces of the Algar clansmen clustered around him.
"All right, my children. Let's go cut up the Murgo reserves."
And he led them at a gallop as they poured down off of the hill, smoothly swung around the outer flanks of the tightly packed assault forces, and then slashed into the unprepared Murgo units bringing up the rear. The slash-and-run tactics of the clans of the Algars left heaps of sabered dead in their wake as they darted in and out of the milling confusion of terrified Murgos. King Khohag himself led several charges, and his skill with the saber, which was legendary in Algaria, filled his followers with an awed pride as they watched his whip-like blows raining down on Murgo heads and shoulders. The whole thrust of Algar's strategy was based on speed. A sudden dash on a fast horse and a series of lightning-like saber slashes, then out before the enemy could gather his wits. King Kohag's saber arm was the fastest in Algaria.
"My king,"
one of his men shouted, pointing toward the center of several close-packed Murgo regiments milling about in a shallow valley a few 100 yards away.
"There's the Black Banner."
King Kohag's eyes suddenly gleamed as a wild hope surged through him.
"We bring my banner to the front,"
he roared, and the clansmen who carried the burgundy and white banner of the chief of the clan chiefs galloped forward with the standard streaming above his head.
"Let's go, my children,"
Khohag shouted, and drove his horse directly at the Murgos in the valley. With saber raised, the crippled king of the Algars led his men down into the Murgo horde. His warriors slashed to the right and to the left, but Khohag plunged directly at the center, his eyes fixed on the black banner of Tar-Ogas, king of the Murgos. And then, in the midst of the household guard, Khohag saw the blood-red mail of Tar-Ogas himself. Khohag raised his bloody saber and shouted a ringing challenge.
"Stand and fight, you Murgo dog!"
Startled by the shout, Tar-Ogas wheeled his horse to stare incredulously at the charging king of Algaria. His eyes suddenly bulged with the fervid light of insanity, and his lips foam-flacked drew back in a snarl of hatred.
"Let him come! Clear the way for him!"
The startled members of his personal guard stared at him.
"Make way for the king of Algaria!"
Tar-Ogas shrieked.
"He is mine!"
And the Murgo troops melted out of Kohag's path. The Algar king reined in his horse.
"And so, it is finally come, Tar-Ogas,"
he said coldly.
"It has indeed, Khohag,"
Tar-Ogas replied.
"I have waited for this moment for years. If I had known you were waiting, I would have come sooner. Today is your last day, Khohag."
The Murgo king's eyes were completely mad now. Foam drooled from the corners of his mouth.
"Do you plan to fight with threats and hollow words, Tar-Ogas? Or have you forgotten how to draw your sword?"
With an insane shriek, Tar-Ogas ripped his broad-bladed sword from its scabbard and drove his black horse toward the Algar king.
"Die!"
he howled, slashing at the air even as he charged.
"Die, Khohag!"
It was not a duel, for there were proprieties in a duel. The two kings hacked at each other with an elemental brutality, thousands of years of pent-up hatred boiling in their blood. Tar-Ogas, totally mad now, sobbed and gibbered as he swung his heavy sword at his enemy. Khohag, cold as ice, and with an arm as fast as the flicking tongue of a snake, slid the crushing Murgo's blows aside, catching them on his sliding saber, and flicking his blade like a whip, its edge biting again and again into the shoulders and face of the king of the Murgos. The two armies, stunned by the savagery of their encounter, recoiled and gave the mounted kings room for their deadly struggle. Frothing obscenities, Torugos hacked insanely at the elusive form of his foe, but Kohag, colder yet, fainted and parried and flicked his whistling saber at the Murgo's bleeding face. Finally, driven past even what few traces of reason were left to him, Torugos hurled his horse directly at Kohag with a wild animal scream on his lips. Standing in his stirrups, he grasped his sword hilt in both hands, raising it like an axe to smash his enemy forever. But Kohag danced his horse to one side and thrust with all of his strength, even as Torugos began his massive blow. With a steely rasp, his saber ran through the Murgo's blood-red mail and through the tensed body, emerging dripping from his back. Unaware in his madness that he had just received a mortal wound, Torugos raised his sword again, but the strength drained from his arms, and the sword fell from his grasp. With stunned disbelief, he gaped at the saber emerging from his chest, and a bloody froth burst from his mouth. He lifted his hands like claws as if to tear away the face of his enemy, but Kohag contemptuously slapped his hands away, even as he pulled his slender curved blade out of the Murgo's body with a slithering whistle.
"And so it ends, Torugos," he declared in an icy voice. "No,"
Torugos croaked, trying to pull a heavy dagger from his belt. Kohag watched his feeble efforts coldly. Dark blood suddenly spurted from the open mouth of the Murgo king, and he toppled weakly from his saddle. Struggling, coughing blood, Torugos lurched to his feet, gurgling curses at the man who had just killed him.
"Good fight, though," Kohag told him with a bleak smile, and then he turned to ride away.
Torugos fell, clawing at the turf in impotent rage. "Come back and fight," he sobbed. "Come back."
Kohag glanced over his shoulder.
"Sorry, Your Majesty, but I have pressing business elsewhere. I am sure that you understand."
And with that he began to ride away.
"Come back,"
Torugos wailed, belching blood and curses and digging his fingers into the earth.
"Come back."
And then he collapsed face down in the bloody grass.
"Come back and fight, Kohag," he gasped weakly.
The last that Kohag saw of him, the dying king of Tol Murgos, was biting at the sod and clawing at the earth with trembling fingers. A vast moan shuddered through the tight-packed regiments of the Murgos, and a sudden cheer rose from the ranks of the Algars as Kohag, victorious, rode back to join his army.
"They are coming again,"
General Varana announced with cool professionalism as he watched the waves of oncoming Malorians.
"Where is that signal?"
Rodar demanded, staring intently downriver.
"What's Sandhig doing down there?"
The front ranks of the Malorian assault struck with a resounding crash. The Drasnian pikemen began to thrust with their long, wide-bladed spears, wreaking havoc among the red-garbed attackers, and the legions raised their shields in the interlocked position that presented a solid wall against which the Malorians beat futilely. Upon a sharp, barked command, the legionaries turned their shields slightly, and each man thrust his lance out through the opening between his shield and the next. The Tolnedran lances were not as long as the Drasnian pikes, but they were long enough. A huge, shuddering cry went through the front ranks of the Malorians, and they fell in heaps beneath the feet of the men behind.
"Are they going to break through?"
Rodar puffed. Even though he was not directly involved in the fighting, the Drasnian king began to pant at each Malorian charge. Varana carefully assessed the strength of the assault.
"No," he concluded. "Not this time. Have you worked out how you're going to make your withdrawal? It is a little difficult to pull back when your troops are engaged.
That's why I am saving the Mimbrates, Rodar replied. They're resting the horses now for one last charge. As soon as we get the signal from Monheg, Mondoralan and his men will shove the Malorians back, and the rest of us will run like rabbits.
The charge will only hold them back for so long, Verlana advised, and then they will come after you again.
We'll form up again upriver a ways.
It is going to take a long time to get back to the escarpment if you are going to have to stop and fight every half mile or so.
I know, Rodar snapped peevishly. Have you got any better ideas?
No, Verlana replied. I was just pointing it out, that's all.
Where is that signal?
Rodar demanded again. On a quiet hillside, some distance from the struggle taking place on the north bank, the simple-minded serf boy from the Arendish forest was playing his flute. His melody was mournful, but even in its sadness it soared to the sky. The boy did not understand the fighting, and he had wandered away unnoticed. Now he sat alone on the grassy hillside in the warm mid-morning sunlight, with his entire soul pouring out of his flute. The Malorian soldier, who was creeping up behind him with a drawn sword, had no ear for music. He did not know, nor care, that the song the boy played was the most beautiful song any man had ever heard. The song ended very suddenly, never to begin again. The stream of casualties being carried to Ariana's makeshift hospital grew heavier, and the overtaxed Mimbrate girl was soon forced into making some cruel decisions. Only those men with some chance of survival could be treated. The mortally hurt were quickly given a drink of bitter-tasting potions of herbs that would ease their pain, and then they were left to die. Each such decision wrung Ariana's heart, and she worked with tears standing in her eyes. Then Brand, the Riven Warder, entered the tent with a stricken face. The big Riven's mail shirt was blood-spattered, and there were savage sword cuts along the edge of his broad, round shield. Behind him, three of his sons bore the limp, bleeding form of their younger brother, Olban.
"Can you see to him?"
Brand asked Ariana hoarsely. A single glance, however, told the blonde girl that the wound in Olban's chest was mortal.
"I can make him comfortable," she replied a bit evasively.
She quickly knelt beside the bleeding young man, lifted his head, and held a cup to his lips.
"Father,"
Olban said weakly after he had drunk,
"I have something I have to tell you."
"Time enough for that later," Brand told him gruffly. "After you're better."
"I'm not going to get better, father,"
Olban said in a voice scarcely more than a whisper.
"Nonsense,"
Brand told him, but there was no conviction.
"There's not much time, father,"
Olban said, coughing weakly.
"Please, listen."
"Very well, Olban,"
the warder said, leaning forward to catch his son's words.
"At Riva, after Belgarion came, I was humiliated because you had been deposed. I couldn't bear it, father."
Olban coughed again then, and a bloody froth came from his lips.
"You should have known me better than that, Olban,"
Brand said gently.
"I do. Now. But I was young and proud and Belgarian. A nobody from Sindaria had pushed you from your rightful place."
"It was not my place to begin with, Olban. It was his. Belgarians, the Raven King. That has nothing to do with position or place. It is a duty. And it is his, not mine."
"I hated him," Olban whispered. "I began to follow him every place, wherever he went. I wasn't far behind him."
"What for?"
"At first I didn't know. Then one day he came out of the throne room
wearing his robe and crown. He seemed so puffed up with his own importance, as if he really was a king instead of just a common Sindarian scullion. Then I knew what I had to do. I took my dagger and I threw it at his back.
Bran's face suddenly froze.
For a long time after that I tried to avoid him,
Olben continued.
I knew that what I had done was wrong. Even as the dagger left my fingers, I thought that if I stayed away from him, he'd never find out that I was the one who tried to kill him. Oh, but he has powers, Father. He has ways of knowing things that no man can possibly know. He sought me out one day and gave me back the dagger I'd thrown at him. He told me that I should never tell anyone what I'd done. He did that for you, Father, to keep my disgrace from you.
Grim-faced, Brand rose to his feet. Come, he said to his other three sons. We have fighting to do. No time to waste on traitors. Quite deliberately, he turned his back on his dying son.
I tried to repay his mercy, Father, Olben pleaded. I pledged my life to protecting his queen. Doesn't that count for anything?
Bran's face was stony, and he kept his back turned in grim silence.
Belgarion forgave me, Father. Can't you find it in your heart to forgive me too?
No, I cannot.
Please, Father, don't you have one tear for me?
Not one.
Brand said it, but Arianna saw that his words were a lie. The grim, gray-clad man's eyes were full, but his face remained granite-like. Without another word, he strode from the tent. Wordlessly, each of Olwen's brothers clasped his hand in turn, and then they left to follow their father. Olben wept quietly for a time, but then his growing weakness and the drug Arianna had given him drained away his grief. He lay half-dozing on his pallet for a time, then struggled to raise himself and beckoned to the Mimbrate girl. She knelt beside him, supporting him with one arm about his shoulders, and her head bent to catch his faltering words.
Please, tell her majesty what I said to my father. Tell her how sorry I was.
And then his head fell forward against Arianna, and he quietly died in her arms. Arianna had no time to mourn, for precisely then three Sindars carried Colonel Brendig into her tent. The colonel's left arm was mangled beyond all hope of repair.
We were bringing down the bridge that crosses to the city, one of the Sindars reported tersely. It was a support that wouldn't give way, so Colonel went down himself to chop it away. When it finally broke, the timbers of the bridge fell right on him.
Arianna gravely examined Brendig's shattered arm.
I fear there is no recourse, my lord. The arm will have to come off, lest it mortify and carry thy life away with it.
Brendig nodded soberly.
That's about what I'd expected. I suppose we had better get on with it, then.
There, King Rodar shouted, pointing downriver. The smoke, it is green. That is the signal. We can start the retreat now.
General Varana, however, was staring at the river bank upstream.
It is too late, I am afraid, Your Majesty. A column of Malorians and Nadraks have just reached the river to the west of us. It very much looks as if we have been cut off.
Chapter 18. The news of the death of Tau Urgas spread through the Murgol army in a vast groan, and the heart went out of the black-robed troops. Tau Urgas had been feared by his men, but his savage madness had lent them all a peculiar sense that they were invincible. They had felt somehow that nothing could stand in his path, and that they, as the instruments of his brutal will, shared in some measure his apparent invulnerability. But with his death, each Murgo became aware with a sudden cold touch of fear that he also could die, and the assault on the armies of the west along the south bank faltered. King Kohag watched the crumbling of the Murgo resolve with a certain grim satisfaction, then rode down to the lines of infantry and the milling Mimbrate knights to confer with the other leaders. King Fulrak strode forward from the ranks of his Sindars. The dumpy, brown-bearded monarch looked almost comical in his burnished breastplate, but his sword showed signs of recent use, and his helmet was dented in a couple of places, mute evidence that the King of Sindaria had participated in the fight.
"Have you seen Unheg's signal yet?" Fulrak demanded as he approached.
Kohag shook his head.
"It should come any time now, though," he replied. "We had better make some plans. Have you seen Coradulan?"
"The physicians are working on him," Fulrak said.
"Is he hurt?"
"I don't think it's too serious. He went to help his friend, the Baron of Oebo, and a Murgo hit him in the head with a mace. His helmet absorbed most of the blow. He's bleeding out of the ears a bit, though. The physicians say he will recover. The Baron's in worse shape, I'm afraid."
"Who is in charge of the Mimbrates, then?"
"Sir Andrig. He's a good man in a fight, but his understanding is a bit limited."
Kohag laughed shortly.
"You have just described most of Orindia, my friend. They are all good in a fight, and they all have limited understanding."
Carefully he dismounted, holding onto his saddle as his weak legs nearly buckled.
"We can make our decisions without Andrik's help, I think."
He looked at the retreating Murgos.
"As soon as we see Anheg's signal, I think we are going to want to get out of here in a hurry. The Murgos are demoralized right now, but they will probably stiffen up again as soon as the shock wears off."
Fulrak nodded.
"Did you really kill Tauragas in a duel?"
Kohag nodded.
"It really was not all that much of a duel. He was raving when he came at me, and he did not even try to defend himself. When Anheg signals, we will have the Mimbrates charge the Murgo front. The Murgos will probably break and run. I will follow after them with my clansmen to hurry them along. That should give you and your foot troops time to start up river. Andorig and I will keep the Murgos off your back until you get clear. How does that sound to you?"
King Fulrak nodded.
"It sounds workable," he agreed. "Do you think they'll try to follow us then?"
Kohag grinned.
"I will encourage them not to," he replied. "Have you got any idea of what's going on across the river?"
"It's hard to say, but things don't look very good."
"Can you think of any way that we can send them help?"
"Not on short notice," Fulrak answered.
Neither can I," Kohag said.
He began to pull himself back into the saddle.
"I will go give Andorig his instructions. Keep your eyes open for Anheg's signal."
"Belgarath!"
Zinedra called out silently, her hand tightly clasped about the amulet at her throat.
"Belgarath, can you hear me?"
She was standing several yards away from where Darnik was trying to make the unconscious Polgara as comfortable as possible. The princess had her eyes tightly closed, and she was putting every ounce of concentration into casting her thought to the sky, reaching out with all of her heart toward the ancient sorcerer.
"Zinedra?"
The old man's voice was as clear as if he were standing beside her.
"What are you doing? Where's Polgara?"
"Oh, Belgarath,"
the princess almost sobbed with relief.
"Help us. Lady Polgara's unconscious, and the Malorians are attacking again. We're being slaughtered, Belgarath. Help us."
"Slow down," he commanded brusquely. "What happened to Paul? Where are you?"
"We are at Tol Mordu," Zinedra replied. "We had to take the city so the Kerrig fleet could go on down the river. The Malorians and the Murgos crept up on us. They have been attacking since early this morning."
Belgarath started to swear.
"What's wrong with Paul?"
he demanded harshly.
"The Grolums. They brought in an awful storm, and then there was the fog. Lady Polgra and Belden made the wind blow, and then she just collapsed. Belden said that she exhausted herself and that we have to let her sleep.
Where is Belden?
He said that he had to keep an eye on the Grolems. Can you help us, Belgarath?
Tanedra, I am 1,000 leagues away from you. Geryon, Silk, and I are in Meloria, practically on Torak's doorstep. If I so much as raise my hand, it will wake him, and Geryon's not ready to meet him yet.
You're doomed, then,
Tanedra wailed.
Stop that, he snapped. This isn't the time for hysterics. You're going to have to wake Polgara.
We've tried, and Belden says that we've got to let it rest.
She can rest later, Belgarath retorted. Is that bag she always carries somewhere about, the one she keeps all those herbs in?
I think so. Durnik was carrying it a little while ago.
Durnik's with you? Good. Now listen, and listen carefully. Get the bag and open it. What you want will be in a silk pouch. Don't open any jars or bottles. She keeps her poisons in those. In one of the silk bags you will find a yellow-colored powder. It has a very acrid odor to it. Put a spoonful or so of that powder into a pot of boiling water. Put the pot beside Paul's head and cover her face with a cloak so she has to breathe the fumes.
What will that do?
It will wake her up.
Are you sure?
Don't argue with me, Zenedra. She will wake up, believe me. Those fumes could wake up a dead stick. As soon as she's awake, she will know what to do.
Tanedra hesitated.
Is Geryon there?
She blurted finally.
He's asleep. We had a rough time last night.
When he wakes up, tell him that I love him.
She said it very fast, as if afraid that if she thought about it at all, she would not be able to say it.
Why confuse him? The old man asked her.
Belgarath?
Tinedra's voice was stricken.
Oh, I was teasing. I'll tell him. Now, get to work. Don't do this anymore. I'm trying to sneak up on Torak. And it's a little hard to sneak when you're shouting at somebody 1,000 leagues away.
We aren't shouting.
Oh, yes, we are. It is a special kind of shouting, but it's shouting all the same. Now, take your hand off that amulet and get to work.
And then his voice was gone. Durnik, of course, would never understand. So Tanedra did what was necessary by herself. She rummaged around until she found a small pot. She filled it with water and set it on the small fire the smith had built the night before. Then she opened Polgara's herb bag. The blonde child, Erend, stood at her side, watching her curiously.
What you doing there, princess?
Durnik asked, still hovering anxiously over the sleeping Polgara.
I'm fixing something to make her rest easier,
Tanedra lied.
Are you sure you know what you're doing? Some of those are very dangerous.
I know which one I'm looking for, she replied. Trust me, Durnik.
The powder she finally located was so acrid that it made her eyes water. She carefully measured out a bit of it and dumped it into the pot. The steaming fumes were awful, and the princess kept her face averted as she carried the pot to where Polgara lay. She set the pot beside the lady's pale, sleeping face, and then laid a cloak across her.
"Give me a stick,"
the princess said to the smith. Durnik, his face dubious, handed her a broken-off arrow. Tanedra carefully propped up the cloak, making a small tent over the pot and Polgara's face.
"What now?" Durnik asked.
"No, we wait,"
Tanedra told him. Then, coming from the direction of the battle, a group of Sindarian soldiers, evidently wounded, appeared at the top of the grassy bank surrounding the secluded little beach. Their jerkins all had bloodstains on them, and several of the men wore bandages. Unlike most of the wounded who had already passed that morning, these men still carried their weapons. Under the tinted cloak, Polgara began to cough.
"What have you done?"
Durnik cried, snatching the cloak away.
"It was necessary,"
Tanedra replied.
"I talked with Belgarath. He told me that I had to wake her up, and how to do it."
"You'll hurt her," Durnik accused.
With sudden uncharacteristic anger, he kicked the fuming pot, sending it rolling down the beach toward the water's edge. Polgara's eyelids were fluttering as she continued to cough. When she opened her eyes, however, her look was blank, uncomprehending.
"Can you spare us some water?"
one of the wounded Sindars asked as the group of men approached.
"There's a whole river right there,"
Tenedra replied absently, pointing even as she intently stared into Polgara's eyes. Durnik, however, gave the man a startled look, then suddenly reached for his sword. But the men in the Sindarian jerkins had jumped down from the bank and were already upon them. It took three of them to disarm the powerful smith and to hold his arms.
"You're not Sindars,"
Durnik exclaimed, struggling with his captors.
"Clever of you to notice,"
one of them replied in an accent so guttural that it was almost unintelligible. Another of them drew his sword and stood over the dazed Polgara.
"Stop fighting, friend,"
he told Durnik with an ugly smirk,
"or I'll kill this woman."
"Who are you?"
Tenedra demanded indignantly.
"What do you think you're doing?"
"Actually, we are members of the Imperial Elite Guard,"
the man with the sword answered urbanely.
"And we are here, Your Highness, to extend to you the invitation of His Imperial Majesty, Zakaath, Emperor of Meloria. His Majesty requests the honor of your presence in his pavilion."
His face hardened, and he looked at his men.
"Bring them,"
he ordered.
"Let's get out of here before someone comes along and starts asking questions."
"They are digging in,"
Hetar reported to King Rodar, gesturing toward the west. "And they are now blocked escape route.
They have already got a trench line running from the river for about a half mile."
"Is there any chance of going around them?"
Rodar asked. Hetar shook his head.
"That whole flank is seething with Nadrax."
"We'll have to go through them, then,"
the King of Drasnia decided.
"I cannot very well attack trenches with cavalry,"
Hetar pointed out.
"We'll storm them with infantry units,"
Rodar declared.
"We will have a certain advantage. The Asturian bows have a longer range than the short ones the Malorians use. We'll move the archers to the front as we advance. They can rake the trenches and then harass the Malorian archers behind the lines. The pikemen will go in first."
The sweating fat man looked at General Varana.
"Can your legionnaires clear the trenches once we open a hole for you?"
Varana nodded.
"We train extensively for trench fighting," he replied confidently. "We will clear the trenches."
"We'll bring the wounded with the main force,"
Rodar said.
"Somebody locate Polgara and the princess. It is time to leave."
"What task hast thou for Lord Hetar and me?"
Mandaraman inquired. The great knight's armor showed a number of dents, but he spoke as calmly as if he had not spent the entire morning involved in heavy fighting.
"I want you and your knights to hold the rear," Rodar told him. "Keep that army out there off my back."
He turned then to Hetar.
"And I want you and your clansmen to go to work on the Nadrax. I don't want them to come swarming in while we're working in the trenches."
"It is a desperate move, King Rodar,"
General Varana said.
"Attacking even hasty fortifications is always costly. And you're going to do it with another army coming at you from the rear. If your attack is beaten back, you will be caught between two superior forces. They will grind you to dog meat right on the spot."
"I know,"
Rodar admitted glumly.
"But our only hope of escape is breaking through those lines that have us blocked off. We have got to get back upriver. Tell your men that we have to take those trenches on the first charge. Otherwise, we're all going to die right here. All right, gentlemen. Good luck."
Once again, Mandaralan led his steel-clad knights in their fearsome charge, and once again the attacking Malorians recoiled, driven back by the dreadful shock as the mounted men of Mimbre struck at their front ranks. This time, however, the pikemen and legionnaires, as soon as they were disengaged from the enemy, turned sharply to the left and, at a jingling trot, abandoned their positions to follow the Sindars and Asturians, who were already withdrawing from the field toward the west. The delaying action of the Mimbrate knights was costly. Riderless horses galloped wildly about the battlefield, quite frequently adding to the havoc by trampling through the Malorian ranks. Here and there, among the red tunics that carpeted the field, lay the single gleaming form of a fallen knight. Again and again, the Mimbrates hurled themselves against the advancing red tide, slowing the Malorians, but not quite able to stop them.
"It is going to be tight, Your Majesty,"
General Varana advised as he and King Rodar rode toward the hastily drawn lines blocking their escape.
"Even if we break through, the bulk of the Malorian forces are going to be hot on our heels."
"You've got a great talent for the obvious, General. As soon as we get through, we will put the archers at the rear and let the Malorians march through a rain of arrows. That will hold them back."
"Yes, until the archers run out of arrows."
"After we break through, I will send the Algars on ahead. Fulrak's got a whole wagon load of arrows at the rapids for every man."
"Which is 2 days' march ahead."
"Do you always look at the dark side of things?"
"I am just trying to anticipate, Your Majesty."
"Would you mind anticipating someplace else?"
The Algars had moved out to the right flank of the retreating army and were gathering in their characteristic small bands, preparing to charge the Nedrax drawn up on the hills above the river. Chetar, his scalp lock streaming, moved forward at a steady lope. His saber was drawn and his eyes looked like flint. The Nedrax appeared at first to be awaiting his charge, but then, amazingly, they turned away and rode rapidly toward the river. From the midst of that sudden surge, a half-dozen men riding under the Nedrak banner swerved out toward the advancing Algars. One of the riders was waving a short stick with a white rag tied to it. The group reined in sharply about 100 yards in front of Hetar's horse.
"You've got to talk to Rodar," one of the Nedraks bellowed in a shrill voice.
He was a tall, emaciated man with a pockmarked face and a scraggly beard, but on his head he wore a crown.
"Is this some sort of trick?"
Hetar shouted back.
"Of course it is, you jackass,"
the scrawny man replied.
"But it's not on you this time. Get me to Rodar, at once!" "Keep an eye on them,"
Hetar told a nearby clan chief, pointing at the Nedrak forces now streaming toward the Malorian trenches, lying in the path of the retreating army.
"I will take this maniac to see King Rodar."
He turned and led the group of Nedrak warriors toward the advancing infantry.
"Rodar!"
the thin man wearing the crown shrieked as they approached the Drasnian king.
"Don't you ever answer your mail."
"What are you doing, Drosta?"
King Rodar shouted back.
"I'm changing sides, Rodar,"
King Drosta Lekton replied with an almost hysterical laugh.
"I'm joining forces with you. I have been in touch with your queen for weeks. Didn't you get her messages?"
"I thought you were playing games."
"Naturally I'm playing games,"
the Nedrak king giggled.
"I've always got something up my sleeve. Right now, my army's opening an escape route for you. You do want to escape, don't you?"
"Of course I do."
"So do I. My troops will butcher the Malorians in those trenches, and then we can all make a run for it."
"I don't trust you, Drosta," Rodar said bluntly.
"Rodar," Drosta said in mock chagrin. "How can you say that to an old friend?"
He giggled again, his voice shrill and nervous.
"I want to know why you are changing sides in the middle of a battle, particularly when your side is winning."
"Rodar, my kingdom is awash with Malorians. If I don't help you to defeat them, Zakath will simply absorb Grognadrak. It's much too long and involved to talk about now. Will you accept my aid?"
"I'll take all the help I can get."
"Good. Maybe later we can get drunk together and talk things over, but for right now, let's get out of here before Zakath hears about this and comes after me personally."
The king of Grognadrak laughed again, that same shrill, almost hysterical laugh.
"I did it, Rodar. I actually betrayed Zakath of Maloria and got away with it."
"You haven't gotten away with it yet, Drosta," Rodar told him dryly.
I will, if we run fast enough, Rodar. And right now, I really feel like running.
Zakath, dread emperor of boundless Meloria, was a man of medium height with glossy black hair and a pale olive-tinged complexion. His features were regular, even handsome, but his eyes were haunted by a profound melancholy. He appeared to be about 35 years old, and he wore a plain linen robe with no ornament or decoration upon it to indicate his exalted rank. His pavilion stood in the center of the camp of the Melorians, a vast sea of tents standing on the plains of Mishrachak-Thul. The earthen floor of the pavilion was covered with priceless Melorian carpets, and the polished tables and chairs were inlaid with gold and with mother-of-pearl. Candles filled the pavilion with glowing light. Somewhere nearby, a small group of musicians played subdued melodies set in a minor key. The emperor's only companion was a half-grown cat, a common, mackerel-striped tabby, with that gangling, long-legged awkwardness of the adolescent feline. While Zakath watched with a sort of sad-eyed amusement, the young cat stalked a scrap of balled-up parchment, her feet noiseless on the carpet, and her face set in a look of intent concentration. As Princess Tsinedra and her companions were escorted into the pavilion, Zakath, seated on a low, cushioned divan, held up his hand for silence as his eyes still fixed on the cat. "She hunts," the emperor murmured in a dead voice. The cat crept nearer to her intended prey, crouched, and shifted her hind feet nervously, her bottom twitching from side to side and her tail lashing. Then she leaped at the parchment. The ball crackled as she pounced on it, and, startled, she jumped high into the air. She batted the ball experimentally with one paw, suddenly finding a new game. She bounded it across the floor with a series of soft-pawed jabs, scampering after it with awkward enthusiasm. Zakath smiled sadly.
"A young cat," he said, "with much yet to learn."
He rose gracefully to his feet and bowed to Tsinedra.
"Your Imperial Highness,"
he greeted her formally. His voice was resonant, but there was all that peculiar deadness in it.
"Your Imperial Majesty,"
Tsinedra replied, inclining her head in response.
"Please, goodman,"
Zakath said to Dernek, who was supporting the still-dazed Polgra.
"Let the lady rest here."
He indicated the divan.
"I will send for my physicians, and they will see to her indisposition."
"Your Majesty is too kind,"
Tsinedra mouthed the ritual phrase, but her eyes were searching Zakath's face for some hint of his real intentions.
"One is surprised to meet such courtesy, under the circumstances."
He smiled again, rather whimsically.
"And, of course, all Meloians are supposed to be raving fanatics, like Murgos. Courtesy is out of character, right?"
"We have very little information about Meloria and its people,"
the princess responded.
"I was not certain what to expect."
"That is surprising," the emperor observed. "I have a great deal of information about your father and your Aelon friends."
"Your Majesty has the aid of Grolems in gathering intelligence,"
Tenedra said.
"While we must rely on ordinary men."
"The Grolems are overrated, Princess. Their first loyalty is to Torak. They're second to their own hierarchy. They tell me only what they want to tell me. Although, periodically, I manage to have a bit of additional information extracted from one of them. It helps to keep the rest of them honest."
An attendant entered the pavilion, fell to his knees, and pressed his face to the carpet.
"Yes?"
Zakath inquired.
"Your Imperial Majesty, ask that King of Tuldum be brought here,"
the attendant replied.
"Ah, yes, I had nearly forgotten.
Please excuse me for a moment, Princess Tenedra. A small matter requiring my attention. Please, you and your friends, make yourselves comfortable.
He looked critically at Tenedra's armor.
After we have dined, I will have the women of my household see to more suitable clothing for you and for Lady Pogra. Does the child require anything?
He looked curiously at Arand, who was intently watching the cat.
He will be all right, Your Majesty,
Tenedra replied. Her mind was working very rapidly. This urbane, polished gentleman might be easier to deal with than she had anticipated.
Bring in the king of the Tulls,
Sakath ordered, his hand wearily shading his eyes.
At once, Your Imperial Majesty,
the attendant said, scrambling to his feet and backing out of the pavilion, bent in a deep bow. Gethel, the king of Mishrakakthul, was a thick-bodied man with lank, mud-colored hair. His face was a pasty white as he was led in, and he was trembling violently.
Your Imperial Majesty,
he stammered in a croaking voice.
You forgot to bow, Gethel,
Sakath reminded him gently. One of the Malorian guards doubled his fist and drove it into Gethel's stomach. The Tullish monarch doubled over.
That is much better,
Sakath said approvingly.
I've asked you here in regard to some distressing news I have received from the battlefield, Gethel. My commanders report that your troops did not behave well during the engagement at Tulmardu. I am no soldier, but it seems to me that your men might have stood at least one charge by the Mimbrate knights before they ran away. I'm informed, however, that they did not. Have you any explanation for that?
Gethel began to babble incoherently.
I thought not, Sakath told him. It has been my experience that the failure of people to do what's expected of them is a result of poor leadership. It appears that you have not taken the trouble to encourage your men to be brave. That was a serious oversight on your part, Gethel.
Forgive me, Dred Sakath,
the king of the Tulls wailed, falling to his knees in terror.
But of course I forgive you, my dear fellow,
Sakath told him.
How absurd of you to think that I wouldn't. A reprimand of some sort is in order, though, don't you think?
I freely accept full responsibility,
Gethel declared, still on his knees.
Splendid. Splendid indeed, Gethel. Absolutely splendid. I am so glad that this interview is going so well. We've managed to avoid all kinds of unpleasantness.
He turned to the attendant.
Would you be so good as to take King Gethel out and have him flogged?
At once, Your Imperial Majesty.
Gethel's eyes started from his head as the two soldiers dragged him to his feet.
Now, Sakath mused, what do we do with him? After we have flogged him.
He thought for a moment.
Ah, I know. Is there any stout timber in the vicinity?
It is all open grassland, Imperial Majesty.
Ah, what a pity. I was going to have you crucified, Gethel. But I suppose I'll have to forego that. Perhaps an extra 50 lashes will serve as well.
Gethel began to blubber.
Oh, come now, my dear fellow. That just won't do. You are a king, after all. And you absolutely must provide a good example for your men. Run along now. I have guests. One hopes that the sight of your public flogging will give your troops greater incentive to do better. They will reason that if I do that to you, then what I'll do to them will be infinitely worse. When you recover, encourage them in that belief, because the next time this happens, I'll have had made arrangements to have the necessary timbers on hand. Take him away,
he said to his men, without so much as a glance over his shoulder.
"Forgive me the interruption, Your Highness," he apologized. "These little administrative details consume so much of one's time."
The King of the Tolls was dragged sobbing from the pavilion.
"I have ordered a small supper for you and your friends, Princess Tenedra,"
Zakath continued.
"All of the finest delicacies. Then I'll make arrangements for the absolute comfort of you and your companions."
"I hope that this won't offend your Imperial Majesty,"
Tenedra began bravely.
"But one is curious about your plans in regard to our future?"
"Please, set your mind at rest, Your Highness. Word has reached me that the madman Tor Urgas is dead. I will never be able to repay you for that service. And I bear you absolutely no ill will whatsoever."
He glanced toward one corner of his tent, where his cat, purring ecstatically, was lying on her back in Eran's lap with all four paws in the air. The smiling child was gently stroking her furry belly.
"How charming,"
Zakath murmured in an oddly melancholy voice. Then the Emperor of Boundless Meloria rose and approached the divan where Durnik supported Lady Polgra.
"My queen," he said,
bowing to her with profound respect.
"Your beauty quite transcends all reports."
Polgra opened her eyes and gave him a level gaze. A wild hope leaped in Zenedra's heart. Polgra was conscious.
"You are courteous, my lord,"
Polgra told him in a weak voice.
"You are my queen, Polgra, and I can now understand my god's ages-old longing for you."
He sighed then as his apparently habitual melancholy descended upon him once again.
"What are you going to do with us?"
Durnik asked, his arms still holding Polgra protectively. Zakath sighed again.
"The god of my people is not a good or kindly god," he told the smith. "If the arranging of things had been left to me, all might have been different. I was not consulted, however. I am Angarak, and I must bow to the will of Torak. The sleeping of the dragon god grows fitful, and I must obey his commands. Though it wounds me deeply, I must turn you and your companions over to the Grolems. They will deliver you to Zedar, disciple of Torak in Hral Mishrak, City of Night, where he will decide your fate."
Part 3. Meloria. Chapter 19. They remained for nearly a week in the imperial compound as the personal guests of Emperor Zakath, who, for some strange reason, seemed to take a melancholy pleasure in their company. Quarters were provided for them within the labyrinth of silken tents and pavilions that sheltered Zakath's household staff, and their every comfort received the personal attention of the Emperor himself. The strange, sad-eyed man puzzled Princess Tenedra. Although he was the absolute soul of courtesy, the memory of his interview with King Gethel frightened her. His ruthlessness was all the more chilling because he never lost his temper. He never seemed to sleep either. And when, often in the middle of the night, he felt some obscure need for conversation, he would send for Tenedra. He never apologized for having interrupted her rest. It apparently did not even occur to him that his summons might in some way inconvenience her.
"Where did King Rodar receive his military training?"
Zakath asked her during one of these midnight interviews.
"None of my information about him even hints about any such talents."
The Emperor was seated deep in the purple cushions of a soft chair, with golden candlelight playing over his face and his cat dozing in his lap.
"I really could not say, Your Majesty,"
Tenedra replied. toying absently with the sleeve of the pale silk gown that had been provided for her soon after her arrival.
I only met Rodar last winter.
Very peculiar, Zakath mused. We had always assumed that he was just a foolish old man, doting on his young wife. We had never even considered him a possible threat. We concentrated our attentions on Brand and Anheg. Brand is too self-effacing to be a good leader, and Anheg seemed too erratic to give us much concern. Then Rodar appeared out of nowhere to take charge of things. The Alarns are an enigma, aren't they? How can a sensible Tonedran girl stand them?
She smiled briefly.
They do have a certain charm, Your Majesty,
she told him rather pertly.
Where is Belgerion?
The question came without any warning.
We don't know, Your Majesty,
Tenedra answered evasively.
Lady Polgara was furious when he slipped away.
In the company of Belgarath and Keldar,
the Emperor added.
We heard of the search for them. Tell me, Princess, does he by any chance have Kragyaska with him?
Kragyaska?
The Burning Stone. What you in the West call the Orb of Aldur.
I'm not at liberty to discuss that, Your Majesty,
she told him rather primly.
And I am sure that you are too courteous to try to wring the information out of me.
Princess, he said reprovingly.
I am sorry, Your Majesty,
she apologized, and gave him that quick little girl smile that was always her weapon of last resort. Zakath smiled gently.
You are a devious young woman, Tenedra.
Yes, Your Majesty,
she acknowledged.
What prompted you and Tar-Ogas to bury your enmity and unite against us?
Tenedra wanted to demonstrate that she, too, could ask surprise questions.
There was no unity in our attack, Princess. I was merely responding to Tar-Ogas.
I don't understand.
So long as he remained at Rakgaska, I was perfectly content to stay at Tulzelik. But as soon as he began to march north, I had to respond. The land of the Tulls is of too much strategic importance to allow it to be occupied by a hostile force.
And so what now, Zakath?
Tenedra asked him impudently.
Tar-Ogas is dead. Where will you turn now in search of an enemy?
He smiled a wintry smile.
How little you understand us, Tenedra. Tar-Ogas was only the symbol of Mogo fanaticism. Tuchik is dead, and Tar-Ogas is dead. But Morgodom lives on, even as Meloria will live on when I am gone. Our enmity goes back for aeons. At least, however, a Melorian emperor is in a position to crush Ktor Melgos once and for all, and to make himself undisputed over-king of Angarak.
It is all for power, then?
What else is there? He asked her sadly. When I was very young, I thought there might be something else. But events proved that I was wrong.
A brief look of pain crossed his face, and he sighed.
In time, you will discover that same truth. Your Belgerion will grow colder as the years pass, and the chill satisfaction of power comes more and more to possess him. When it is complete, and only his love of power remains, then he and I will move against each other, as inevitably as two great tides. I will not attack him until his education is complete. There is no satisfaction in destroying a man who does not fully comprehend reality.
when all of his illusions are gone, and only his love of power remains, then will he be a fit opponent.
His face had grown bleak. He looked at her, his eyes as dead and as cold as ice.
I think I have kept you from your rest too long, Princess. Go to bed. Dream of love and other absurdities. The dreams will die all too soon. So enjoy them while you can.
Early the next morning, Tenedra entered the pavilion where Polgara rested, recuperating from the struggle with the Grolems at Tulmardo. She was alert, but still dreadfully weak.
"He is every bit as insane as Tor Urgos was,"
Tenedra reported.
"He is so obsessed with the idea of becoming Overking of Engrak that he is not even paying any attention to what we've been doing."
"That may change once Unheg starts sinking his troop ships. There is nothing we can do at the moment, so just keep listening to him and be polite."
"Do you think we should try to escape?"
"No."
Tenedra looked at her, a bit startled.
"What's happening is supposed to happen. There is some reason that the four of us, you, Dernick, Erend, and I, are supposed to go to Meloria. Let's not tamper with it."
"You knew this was going to happen?"
Polgara gave her a weary smile.
"I knew that's where we were going. I did not know how exactly. Sakath is not interfering in any way, so do not aggravate him."
Tenedra sighed in resignation.
"Oh, whatever you say, Lady Polgara."
It was early afternoon of that same day when the first reports of King Anheg's activities in the Sea of the East reached the Emperor Sakath. Tenedra, who was present when the dispatches were delivered, felt a secret sense of satisfaction as the icy man showed the first hint of irritation she had seen in him.
"Are you certain of this?"
he demanded of the trembling messenger, holding up the parchment.
"I only carried the dispatch, Dreadlord,"
the messenger quailed, cringing back from his emperor's anger.
"Were you at Tulzelek when the ships arrived?"
"There was only one ship, Dreadlord."
"One ship? Out of 50?
Sakath's tone was incredulous.
"Weren't there others, perhaps coming along the coast?"
"The sailor said that there were not, Your Imperial Majesty."
"What kind of barbarian is this Unheg of Karak?"
Sakath exclaimed to Tenedra.
"Each of those ships carried 200 men.
"King Unheg is in Alon, Your Majesty,"
Tenedra replied coolly.
"They are an unpredictable people."
With a great deal of effort, Zakath regained his composure.
"I see," he said after a moment's reflection. "This was your plan from the beginning, wasn't it, Princess? The entire attack on Tulmardo was a subterfuge."
"Not entirely, Your Majesty. I was assured that the city had to be neutralized to permit the passage of the fleet."
"But why is he drowning my soldiers? I bear the Elons no malice."
"Torak does, or so I am told. And it is Torak who will command the combined armies of Engrak. We cannot allow your forces to land on this continent, Your Majesty. We cannot give Torak that advantage."
"Torak is asleep, and he is likely to remain so for a number of years yet."
"Our information indicates that it won't be nearly so long. Belgarath himself is convinced that the time is near at hand."
His eyes narrowed slightly.
"I must hand you all over to the Grolems, then. I had hoped to wait until Polgara had regained her strength before subjecting her to the journey. But if what you say is true, there is little time to waste. Advise your friends to make their preparations, Princess. You will depart for Tulzelek tomorrow morning."
"As Your Majesty wishes,"
Zinedra replied, a chill going down her spine as she bowed her head in acquiescence.
"I'm a secular man, princess," he said by way of explanation. "I bow to the altar of Torak when the occasion demands it. But I make no pretense at excessive piety. I will not involve myself in a religious dispute between Belgarath and Zedar, and I most certainly will not stand between Torak and Ardor when they confront each other. I would strongly advise you to follow the same course."
"The decision is not mine to make, Your Majesty. My part in this was decided for me long before I was born."
He looked amused.
"The prophecy, you mean. We Angaraks have one also, princess. And I do not imagine yours is any more reliable than ours. Prophecy is no more than a trick of the priesthood to maintain its grip on the gullible."
"Then you believe in nothing, my lord?"
"I believe in my own power. Nothing else makes any sense."
The Grolems, who escorted them in easy stages northward across the summer-browned plains of Mishrek Akhtal toward Tolzerek, were coldly proper. Zinedra could not be sure if their behavior was the result of warnings from the Emperor of Meloria, or their fear of Polgara.